Welcome to Innovent Korea. Today, my guest is Scott Withhoft. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how are you?
Brilliant. So you're many things, educator, designer. We're here today because you're the author of the book, This is a Prototype? Question mark. And I love the subtitle. It's The Curious Craft of Exploring New Ideas. So I really wanted to do one episode on prototyping, to demystify what it means, and to give people a bunch of tools and tips to be able to prototype effectively and efficiently. Cool. And I think your book is, it's a small book, and I'll put in the notes all the links, because I think people should really get it, but it's such a beautiful object. And it's colorful, and there are tools literally in it that you can take out. So it's brilliant. But it's so packed with information. So it's really wonderful. It's such a good reference book.
Wow, thanks so much. I'm so pleased that it's resonating with you. We tried to jam it full of useful bits. So hopefully that helps folks who are
reading. I'm curious, how many prototypes were made to create the final version of the book?
A lot. Yeah. I think that's a neat question. I think in the sense that, you know, like books and the writing process and publishing has been around for, mm-hmm. I mean, since whenever, that it seems like, oh, it should be pretty well nailed down or well established. I think the whole, you know, from the publishing team to the production team at the Stanford D School, myself, the illustrator, his name is Scott Teplin, we all of us prototyped many, many, many different versions and aspects of the book while coming up with it. Even in this like very well-known process of, okay, let's put out a book. Like that's the daily business, right? Of
yeah.
At least a publisher. And yet there's still, even now, lots of opportunities for prototyping unknown phrasing, different layouts, almost like storyboarding, like you would in a movie or a cartoon where you sort of think of like bricks of content or chunks and you sort of lay it out and say like, oh, well, what happens if we move that one over here and sort of shuffle them around like a film crew might or film production crew might? That was a really useful prototyping process too. So yeah.
Before we dive into the wonderful world of prototyping, I have to ask you the same question I ask all of my guests. It's the rude question. When you were, I don't know, 10, 12 years old, what were you fascinated about?
Wow.
Passionate about or just curious about? Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
I was curious about a lot of things. You know, when I grew up, I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, in the Southwest in the U.S. It was pretty, it's not rural. That's a little bit exaggerated, but we lived in kind of a deserty area. And there was lots to explore. So lots of different animals and plants and, I know, geographies, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. I was always fascinated with that. It's such a big presence when you're in that place. Sort of like, I suppose, like being in the Alps. You know, you can't mm-hmm. deny it. You're like, they're right
Nature
there.
Nature is there. It's yeah. rich and it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's a sort of all-encompassing. And there were, so certainly nature and in particular the Sonoran Desert, which is that area, was super fascinating to me. I think also just I was really interested in and still am interested in, you know, building physical things. So, you know, I grew up in a household of tools and materials. So there's always like an opportunity to see something being built or potentially to make
Tinker,
stuff.
So really.
Yeah.
To play playfully discover how to build things, make things, create things.
Yeah. Or even just see like touch like what tools were. And like how they felt, like what's the weight of things and, oh, that is sharp, you know, watch out. Or I don't know, even like like on old tools, like hand planes or something like that. Like, oh, that really fits in your hand well. You know, it's very ergonomic. Uh-huh. It doesn't look that way, but oh, that's that's comfortable. Or so I think even just having the like tactile proximity to tools and materials, I don't know.
Kinesthetic learner.
Yeah, certainly.
Definitely, yeah. What is the definition of a prototype?
I think a useful prototype definition is thinking of a prototype as an embodied question and one that you learn from through an experience. I'll note that that's ever so slightly different than how one might conventionally think of a prototype, which is it's a thing or perhaps a version of a final product or an early solution. And I think that those are useful, can be useful definitions, but just for the purpose of running down what is a prototype and what can I learn from prototyping, there's an opportunity to say when I'm prototyping, that is when I'm asking a question with something that I make or something that an experience that I'm creating, I'm still in this position of learning. And it's okay. And in fact, it's important to be in this position of curiosity before I need to be in the position of being correct. So there's tension between I'm going to allow myself to be curious before I need to show up as being correct, or even if my outputs are, so to speak, correct. That is a distinction I've noticed among lots and lots of designers, and I've seen as a real opportunity. And in some cases, maybe it's new permission for folks who are accustomed to being the idea people, or who are accustomed to being the one that always knows the answer, or in fact is paid to be the one with the answer, so to speak.
And to perform, to be right, to have it all correct. There's exactly an exploration before then.
Just to call it your before, since you mentioned before, I think there's an important distinction I think is worth exploring, is considering prototyping as pre or as before a solution, or even if we're not going toward a solution, we don't know what it is yet. Let's just say that. We don't know if there's a solution. There is this phase of prototyping which informs what could come next, but it does not have to be the final work, and in fact shouldn't be the final work. It's this exploration discovery phase that sometimes gets squished or conflated with, okay, that person just happened to guess, like by intuition or experience, whatever, a solution that seems to work.
I love in your book, you say it's a modest tool for the lofty goal of testing the future. I love that. That's what a prototype is, from, you know, experimenting with a recipe that you want to spice up or design differently. That's a prototype. But I love the example you give. It's, you have a night out, you don't know what to wear, and you put out three outfits and you try them on and you mix them up. That is a prototype as well.
Yeah, that seems totally accurate. To make the parallel of, I don't know, prototyping to music, if that fits, like we can acknowledge a room full of musicians, all of whom play different instruments or don't play any instruments. Some people are expert at meter and rhythm. Some people can read written music notation. Some can't, and some don't want to. Yet all of their output and the outcomes from their work can be musical. And I think to connect that back to your point about, you know, a prototype doesn't have to be a machine. It doesn't have to be a thing. It actually is part of very often intuitive behaviors and success mechanisms that people have in their daily lives, in their professional lives, in their personal lives, whether they're responsible for being a designer or a maker of things. Like, you host a dinner party, that's potentially a designed experience and takes the same kind of personal curiosity, interpersonal curiosity that designing a new pair of shoes might. They're different outputs and different outcomes altogether, but the same kind of approach of, huh, I know I'm going to have to land on some kind of idea or some kind of experience. What can I try now to uncover and discover what seems to be working, and further, why does that seem to work? And if I notice something cool, let me hang on to that, and I'll implement that for a next time, a next round. This
and idea. There's an intention. I think that's what needs to be brought to light as well, is you, it doesn't require to be perfect, but you want something out of it.
I think the connecting the idea of low fidelity implementation or low fidelity investigation meaning I'm going to make a cardboard version of something, or I'm going to storyboard, meaning put up some quick sketches of my vacation, whatever. That I would consider low fidelity or low resolution. I'm using expendable materials very quickly. However, low fidelity implementation matched with high fidelity intention, meaning I'm very deliberate right now in choosing those materials so they don't get in the way of my learning. So low fidelity implementation can sometimes, particularly in a professional context, can sometimes seem unprofessional. Like, oh, yes, come on, you're showing me a cardboard version of this? I hired you to, you know, make a final, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
The mapping.
People get caught in that, but they shouldn't.
Like a prototype itself does not have to reflect your fullest skill set of making. However, it should and can represent your best and deepest understanding of being intentional as a learner at the moment. Like I'm going to show up with kind of, paraphrase, I'm going to show up with a junky version of something and I am fully into learning from that junky thing right now.
Yeah.
That's different than saying I made a junky thing because I can only make junky things. That's a missed opportunity or a misconception about prototypes.
Prototype is a journey, isn't it? Really, that's the tool that brings you from exploring A to B to C to D. I like how you say that it's based on utility and motivation as well. How do you explain that? How do you differentiate?
I think that, well, motivation is a cool one. I mean, that's an interesting one in saying like, well, I might have personal motivations for prototyping something like in your own life versus, oh, my motivation for prototyping is always at work. So that's a behavior I can only do at work. And I think there's an opportunity to connect the learning journey, is your point. Like it's kind of a journey.
Yeah.
You can take that journey and it can apply to your different motivations. So if I have, a personal motivation of recreating my daily schedule for it to feel more fulfilling, that is a legitimate motivation and a cool opportunity for taking a prototyping approach. What can I make? What can I learn from? What experiences can I implement and then cycle through? That same motivation might apply with, I don't know, developing a new software package. Like, okay, we've got that version. Let's cycle through it. So I think the utility or the usefulness of prototyping can apply across a range of motivations. And then back to the question you asked about the utility, there are different use cases or different values, or let's say value outcomes, from a different type of prototype. Like, is it something that is aesthetically pleasing for the purpose of learning about the aesthetics of something? So if I want to learn how something should look, I might, you know, go down the path of a quote unquote looks like prototype. Oh, there's a version that has some aesthetic sensibilities that I want to learn about. If there's a curiosity about how something functions, maybe just mechanically, like how do these things operate together? Or what would that new schedule that I'm prototyping look like? I might focus only on the kind of, so to speak, mechanics of it. And I might focus then on, well, let's try a works like or a functional prototype. I'm not concerned at the moment about how it looks or a lot of the sort of aesthetic nuances of it. I'm more curious right now about like, what can I learn about the mechanical infrastructure and then focus on that before I take a next step.
And one of the things you bring forth is the fact that you can easily sort of get attached to a prototype. When I was reading the book, I kept thinking about the mandalas in the Buddhist tradition, making these intricate, beautiful, colorful, complex images with colored sand. And when you're done, you take the broom and you just sweep it away. And it's the same sort of mindset you need to have around how you bring your prototype forth and develop them.
I think there's a couple of, I love that. Those are beautiful, of course. And actually, that introduces an interesting thing of like what the use case is or what the interaction is with those as an observer or as a creator of the thing. So the same person who's making that ornate, elaborate sort of implementation, this beautiful thing, and then sweep it away, like as an observer, I would say, like, oh, wait, you just wrecked a piece of art.
Hardship, right.
You know, and that's my engagement with what was created or the experience that was created, as opposed to that person's who's making it, which may be, it would be hard to say that there aren't aesthetic sensibilities as part of that, but it may be a deeply meditative thing.
But the intention is not the aesthetic. Yeah.
Exactly. So their utility or their interaction with the experience is different, you know, than mine or an outward observer. I think your question about, you know, how can you sort of avoid, I'm paraphrasing, but how can you avoid the trap of maybe going too far or getting too, falling too in love with an idea? I think two things actually that kind of connect back to some content in the book, but there are two sort of useful kind of gut checks. I'd say one is being really explicit about the question that you are asking or focusing on with your work at that moment, so that you're saying, oh, if I added more features to this, or if I put another button here, or if I painted it red versus blue, if you can say, I just made it, I'm in the brink of making a decision. Should I add something more? Should I paint it a different color? Should I do this? If you can, when you recognize, oh, I'm adding something right now, if you can connect that back to, what is it that I'm trying to learn with whatever I'm doing right now? That can be a way of saying, like, I'm going to hold off on that. That's getting too far down the road. It's advancing past a question that I haven't asked yet. Meaning, like, should it be red or blue? Does that even matter? What is the question that you're focusing on? So that's one. If you can ask yourself, hey, if I make a change to whatever I'm doing right now, does that connect to the question that I'm most interested in learning about right now? That's one. I think the second thing is, it is really important and useful to be explicit about a moment when you are going to let go of your work. You're mm-hmm. actually going to mark a moment where I'm not making anything anymore. I'm in some cases, it may be, I am physically handing what I just made to someone else. I'm not touching it. It's like a fledgling, you know, the bird has left the nest. It is no longer part of me. I'm just watching how it flies at this point. You're saying, I'm seeing how someone engages with the work, which in your headspace can shift to, oh, I'm now like an observer of my work versus a shepherd or a guardian or a keeper. You're now watching how someone engages with it. So setting that actual moment of, okay, I got to get it out of my hands or out of my domain, out of my realm. That could be a forcing function of whatever I have done in 1 hour, I'm going to show whatever it is to someone else in 1 hour. So it could be a time constraint. It could be I'm only going to spend $10 or $10 on materials to make something, a version of it. And when that's done, great. I'm going to show it to someone else. That's it. Or
you even bring the idea of making a ritual around that moment, because it is an important moment, because there's been so much work put into it. Whatever amount of time you put into it, it still worked. It was an intention.
Yeah, like you're going to jump in the water. You know, you can stand on the shore and intellectualize about being wet, but it's going to feel totally different if you were in the water. You have to get in the water, so to speak. It's valuable to talk about, oh, what was your technique or how did it work? But you can only have that experience and that, I should say, insight once you've done the thing, once you've taken the leap, so to speak, and you're swimming or sinking, I guess.
But that would be part of the experimentation. And I think that's what is important to identify. And it's really about learning and not about performing. But what comes after? So what happens? You made a prototype. What's the ultimate next step?
That's something that, I mean, to get back to that utility and motivation question that you brought up earlier, you know, hopefully once you've made a prototype or basically turned a question into some kind of experience, you're learning from that. So what comes next is potentially either, you know, a phase of learning or maybe multiple phases of learning that could then lead to a, do I take a next step? Is there another version of this? Or did I learn that, in fact, this isn't a productive route and I should now change maybe trajectory, try a different thing or introduce a new version or a new option? So I think the baseline, what comes next, is you shifting from the maker of a thing or an experience to that of a an observer or an investigator of that experience. So I'm watching and I'm learning from what I just made. And then I'm going to make sense of what I learned. It's not so much about the thing anymore. It might be, let's just say that I made, I don't know, some device and I want to know if it works. I made a device, I handed it to someone else. They said it works. The next step is not like, did it work? Did it not work? But do I know why it worked or do I know why it didn't work? So that's a distinction between like, I had the answer versus I know why that's the answer. Those are two totally different things. And I think when you know, we're talking about what comes next is saying, well, do I know what I need to know now to take a next step? If there is one, what confidence do I have based on what I tried and what I learned that would inform a next step or would inform not taking a next step?
What prototype have you encountered, whether you were working on it or you saw it, that you found most interesting?
I love the value of constraints. They are valuable for lots of reasons. One, they kind of reduce a cognitive load in a way of saying like, well, I'm faced with these constraints. And if I take those as true, I don't have to think about those anymore. I just have to incorporate them. I don't have to think beyond them, so to speak. I've only got a week. I've only got cardboard, to your question of what's a prototype that I found interesting. Instances where there are strong constraints, I find compelling. It kind of raises your curatorial game, so to speak, and saying like, oh, I'm going to try some things in a unique way because these are existing constraints. Cool. Mm-hmm. I'm often like drawn to, if I'm like looking in the past, like what are some interesting prototypes, instances where it seemed like something could not have conventionally been prototyped, but was. And I'll get to a specific thing. I do a lot of work with kind of like across a range of interior design, but basically space design and environments design to support specific behaviors. And very often that's around creating collaborative spaces. That can be a digital space or it can be a physical space. But in the context specifically of physical space, there's often a desire, like when designing the best office, so to speak, to start with a solution or a product first that's intended then to drive the behavior. Like, oh, I'd like my teams to work more collaboratively. So what are the products that I should buy and implement in the office and that will make it collaborative? I've had the opportunity to see and design prototypes and prototype experiences where before we say, oh, that is the correct thing or that's the correct solution, let's try something and see how it works at as large a scale as possible. So that might mean taking over the floor of a building in an office or taking over like one end of a workspace in an existing, you know, building that may be about to be remodeled or in some ways going to have a change in the future. In many instances, when that prototype is introduced, which is like, hey, here's a new way of working. Let's try that way of working for a week, a month, 2 months. So it very quickly surfaces that what we're dealing with right now are actually behaviors as opposed to products. So the conventional approach is if I see a problem or if I want to change a behavior, let me introduce a solution, the perfect whiteboard or the perfect desk or a standing height, such and such, blah, blah, blah. Come to find out that when given the opportunity to work in that particular way, new behaviors might emerge. And in fact, it's not about that solution yet. It's about, oh, we don't have a full grasp or full understanding of how our people are working and why it's important to them. The perfect example of this is the back to the office sort of movement, but right now where it's people don't want to go back to work. People want to work remotely. Well, what if we redesigned our offices to be better? You're like, well, yeah, but wasn't that exactly the same situation before people were given the opportunity to work in this you know, so to speak, perfect office? It wasn't that previously people had wanted offices to be bad. There was tons and tons of money and effort and attention spent on, we're making the perfect workspace. It's like, yeah, it's really not about the space. It's about the people and their behaviors. So what are you doing to prototype and understand those behaviors, not the solution. So like we're starting, unfortunately, with the solution again.
Yes.
And not fully tracking back to, I think this is the same timeline and same context. It applies particularly to, education and schools and teaching. Mm-hmm. So, in instances of where COVID protocols had, people at home or not centrally located a school and people were convening through online services like Zoom, for example. And there were lots of, we can do some different things, or we're now working on all the features of Zoom to make it more like an in-person class experience. Maybe that's valid or is important, but there is something that is really, there is a prototyping mentality that can serve well that phase of time and saying, if we don't think about Zoom or remote learning as the solution, and we don't think about being in person in class together as the solution, but now recognize with our agency and our learning mind, like, what were we able to do with remote experiences? What were we able to do when we're in person? So as opposed to, again, like focusing on, we must be correct. Mm-hmm. Can we kind of defer for a moment and still remain in this realm of curiosity and saying, if I wanted to do an activity like this, actually that I'd be curious how we would do that through Zoom or how we might do that in person. A specific example I can think of as someone who's, tried to introduce new content, new speakers, new material into classroom experiences 10 years ago, one of the absolute worst ways to introduce a remote speaker who wasn't in the room was to have them on a teleconference. And so everybody is now basically in the physical room, is like looking at a big screen. The distance between the speaker and the audience could not have been more amplified. And it was not a cohesive learning experience. However, if you took that same experience and everybody was remote, as we tried by forcing function, by constraint with Zoom and saying, I'm having a remarkable experience from my home with someone who's, across the world and is a world expert.
Exactly.
And is joining the class. All of a sudden, what was the worst way to introduce a new point of view became normal. And it was like the best. You're like, oh, wow. Because everybody's experience was basically equalized. And there's variations of that, mm-hmm. of course. But there's some aspect of, we're all having a much more similar experience in this experience. And as a result, it's kind of great. And in fact, if I was to ever teach a class again, or next time I do teach a class and next time I have guests, wouldn't it be more interesting to, for that moment, say everyone is not in the room, everyone's remote, and we'll have this kind of more universal experience or more equalized experience that can be positive. And then let's be mindful about why and when we're back together in person. So we can see a lot of great prototypes take shape when the outputs aren't seen as the single solution, but when you might learn from the sort of outcomes and the body of what comes, and saying, that could inform our next steps. It doesn't have to be the solution itself. So I'm often looking for that when I'm thinking about and evaluating prototypes. Like, I'm not beholden to the outcomes being the answer right now. I'm going to say, that's great for my learning. I'm going to synthesize that. I'm going to make some sense of it. And then I'm going to make an informed decision about, possible implementations or possible next steps.
The last question I usually ask my guests is about the future. It's my what if. So for your discipline and your practice, what would your dream be around prototyping? What do you envision for that craft? What's your dream around it?
I do love the idea, and I guess it's not just a hope. It's a building on an observation I've had around students. This is a constraint. This is great. They very often are facing a constraint of money. That is not in itself a great thing. It is great and useful to see how people respond to such a constraint, which is, I'm going to be resourceful. I'm going to be thrifty. I'm going to be economical about my choices of materials and even tools that I use. Like, do I rent something? Do I borrow it? Am I using a student subscription to a software package, et cetera? Mm-hmm. There's kind of a little critical moment that gets missed or isn't yet intuitive or is confident among some students. And I'd love to see that as a next step, and it applies to anybody, which is I'd love to see, you know, a future where people equip themselves to activate their agency with their environment and the materials around them. It's a very long way of saying it's not just a use what you have. That's paramount. That's super important. Yes. It's probably like the basis of any successful prototype. Use what you have. Otherwise, you're never going to start. So use what you have. Mm-hmm. Minimize those, any barriers to getting started. However, make sure that you have around you materials and tools and resources that you can use, which can be a mindset shift of saying, oh, I see this room as a resource now versus I didn't even think about this room as something I could use. Or, oh, I've got to use some cheap materials. Where can I get some cardboard? The idea that, oh, I'm going to use cheap materials. So why don't I prepare some cheap materials? Why don't I have some ready to go stuff like within arm's reach, so to speak, or accessible to me? That could be again, like having digital templates, like ready to go. I mean, personally, I have a bunch of sort of out of frame here, but I have a whole stack of giant storyboards that I'm like at any given moment, ready to just like, okay, that project is going to do this. That's a minute. That's 2 minutes. I have some manifested thing. Students, same way. Like, I know that they know how to dumpster dive, so to speak, like go find materials or the stuff behind the art department, you know, in the dumpster, like, oh, this is great. It's free. I don't have to buy it. There's all this wood and whatever. Awesome. Instead of forcing yourself to, in the moment, have to A, go procure those materials, and then B, think about what you're going to do with them. Skip that step, the A, and say like, oh, I'm going to get more intentional about having stuff around me that I think of as a malleable resource, whether that's space, digital assets, physical stuff, whatever. I'm going to be a little bit more physically equipped and mentally equipped such that whenever there's an opportunity to prototype something, I'm kind of ready to go. I've diminished my starting point or barrier to start even more. I feel agency with those things around me that I see as resources to help me get started.
And it can be a trap to think that, oh, I need to buy the perfect material so I don't have the money, or the material is not as perfect as it doesn't need to be perfect. It can be missing. It's fine. You know, I think that for some people, we've lost this idea of experimenting with whatever is around. And it's such a liberating experience.
there's a art criticism and design criticism, not being critical of, but like the bodies of research and knowledge of intellectual criticism in those fields. And that art sometimes is seen as being fundamentally different than design in the sense that, you know, art might serve the artist. It's the audience is potentially immaterial. It's highly debatable, but that design in itself is not about the designer per se. It's fundamentally about the audience. So in the best design, the designer doesn't show up, which is
debatable.
But there is something kind of, I think, useful for anybody that can be borrowed from art for sure, which is that, you know, if we look at sculpture, any historical sculptor, and look at what we know as the final version of that, the final implementation, whether that's, you know, on a site, in a museum, in a private collection, whatever. We see it, it's done, it's beautiful. There are umpteen loads and loads of versions that preceded that.
Yes.
And in some cases are not of the final material. And I think that gets back to like while sculpture is a subtractive effort generally, like I'm removing the chunks of marble or whatever that aren't part of what I want the final form to be. I'm subtracting, I'm making a big block smaller. We can use additive techniques, like I'm going to take a couple of blobs of clay, plop them on top of each other, and mold that into a shape. So two things there. One, I just fundamentally changed the implementation process, like from my final work and my final approach is going to be subtractive. But to learn about that, I'm going to use an additive approach. I'm going to put some stuff together. And I'm using a non-final material intentionally. I'm using some clay. I don't care about the clay. It's just helping me work out a blobby thing. It is not the final version. I think that like anybody can borrow from what might feel conventional or intuitive to an artist and saying, oh, you know what?
Yes.
I can try something. And in fact, I can start with what is not going to be the final material. I can start with cardboard. If I'm going to make a pair of pants, I can start with paper as my starting point, not only just as a template, but like I can sew paper together and that's effectively free. I can learn a lot from that and it's okay. It's almost intuitive in that sense. Like, of course, I'm not going to start with the final material. Why would I do that?
I love that you give that as an example because that's often how I explain it to people. Two things. One, if you go to the museum, and I love when they have the sketch, the study for a painting. So you see that the painter, you look at the painting, there was three characters in a road, I don't know. And then you look at the study, there were two characters, a dog, and it wasn't a road, it was a river. But through the creative process, the artist sketched it before it went on a big canvas or a small canvas, it's irrelevant, but there was a study that is a prototype. And I think we're talking about clay. People forget that cars are designed through huge molds of clay first to see, does that make sense? It is a prototype using a different type of material. Mm-hmm. So what would be your word of encouragement, the last word for people listening?
There is a trap in approaching a new work from a deficit mentality. That's fairly new language to me. I'm learning that. But this idea of, oh, every time I learn something, my takeaway is actually, oh, I didn't know that already, or I'm lacking that information. I think there is an opportunity to connect back to yourself when you're thinking about innovation. And if we think of innovation as fundamentally just change, not a technology solution or a monetary solution or whatever. But if you just said innovation is a new change at its basest definition, if you looked at your normal operating system, meaning how you've gotten to this point in your life, if you're alive right now, you've done something right. You're here.
Yeah.
And you said like, well, how many times did I try something and then learn from that and did something the same way again, or I made a change? I think the idea of prototyping, while it kind of connects very often to technology innovations and material changes, is at its basis level an approach to learning. And that is not restricted to your discipline, your profession, your age, your intellect, anything. It's a matter of saying, I'm going to acknowledge a question I have. And instead of keeping it in my head, I'm going to manifest that question in some way, whether that's through a physical thing or an experience, some engagement. I'm going to get it out of my head such that someone can engage it, including myself. And I'm going to allow myself the moment to learn from it. And then I'm going to do something. That's not something you don't know how to do already. It might not be something that you celebrate or acknowledge as something you do well already. In fact, you might be better at prototyping than someone who teaches prototyping just by the nature of you've tried so many things. You've pivoted so many times. You've experimented with different curiosities. So this all might, as opposed to saying like, here's something you don't know how to do. Learn it because here's someone who's telling me how to do it. I'd offer up, is there
rediscover how you do it. It's really what you're saying. Yeah. Fantastic. What a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much, Scott, for joining.
You're welcome. This was super fun.
I will
appreciate it.
Oh, really? Brilliant. So I will put the link for people to go and get your book because I think it's a fantastic thing to have nearby. Thank you so much, Scott.
You're welcome. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for being with us today. If you enjoyed the podcast, make sure to subscribe to Innovent Korea on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Special thanks to Millimetric, who composed my music themes. I encourage you to discover his music on Bandcamp. Thank you for listening, and bye for now.